If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Rakuten.com.
Evenings with Led Zeppelin. The Complete Concert Chronicle is a new book out by Dave Lewis and Mike Dramaglio, each chronicling the 500 plus appearances of the mighty Zepp made throughout their career, from the earliest gig in Denmark, which I really want to hear about, in a school gymnasium in Denmark. What could possibly go wrong, through to the last gig that Page, Robert Plant and John Paul Jones ever played with John Bonham. Berlin 1980, the Led Zeppelin story told from perhaps the best place to be live. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK and the States, in order, Dave Lewis and Mike Dramaglio. Good afternoon to you. Good afternoon to you, Dave. Good morning to you, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Very good, well, afternoon. Thank you. Good to have you with us. Just tell us, Dave, where are you at the moment on the planet?
I'm in Bedford, in my garage.
And Mike, we're about to see you, my friend.
I'm in Connecticut, in my office.
Fair enough. So tell us, I mean, you would think perhaps that, you know, people have been writing about Led Zeppelin now. It's 40 years since they last got together. Why the fascination with Led Zeppelin live? We know the studio albums. We know, you know, Stairway and the production, the whole bit. But live. Led Zeppelin were a unit and a half, weren't they?
Well, yeah, they very much were. No two nights were the same. You know, as you say, you know, the studio albums were just a starting point. So for Mike and I to be able to chronicle this incredible history of gigs was a massive challenge, but very fulfilling. And I think we've made something that is, you know, is rock history. And it was so much fun to do it. But yeah, Led Zeppelin was a unique live act, and I'm sure Mike can, you know, elaborate on that.
Yeah, I think the key with Led Zeppelin is that, you know, every night was different. You know, unlike some bands who just do their pat set, they do the exact same songs, they do them the exact same way. You know, the four musicians in Led Zeppelin were very unique in that they could take the exact same songs from night to night and make them completely different through their improvisation and just really talented musicians. But I also think an important component of the whole Zeppelin live concert story is that the bootlegs really, they had so many bootlegs, a few hundred bootlegs that really helped the fans get into the band. And on a different night, you're having a different experience. And the hope with the book is that people can take a look through the book, listen to their bootlegs, and you know, take themselves to another area.
One of the things about Led Zeppelin, and, you know, like I said before off air, I'm a massive fan, is the fact that they were, if you like, they were the first stadium band. I mean, they were the first, you know, the Jets, the rock and roll lifestyle. And I've said this before when I've done interviews about Zeppelin, but they really were sort of cutting a swathe. Nobody had ever done this before, you know, not even in the, you know, in the, you know, the wild and rocking days as like Chuck Berry and Elvis and all that stuff. But they weren't acting, they weren't playing, they certainly weren't doing the size of gigs that the Zeppelin were doing. And the same way, the free form style that they were doing it. I mean, you're talking about bootleg. I mean, can you imagine somebody today trying to sort of bootleg, you know, one of the I don't know, an Ed Sheeran, perish the thought, an Ed Sheeran or a Justin Bieber concert?
Probably not, actually, no. But I think one of the great things about the book is the momentum that you get as you wade through the pages and you see how the band grew. I mean, it just didn't happen, you know, overnight. They worked incredibly hard, particularly in the first year in America. you know, they played something like, you know, 150 gigs in the first year. And they earned their craft and they earned their audience. And it was a word of mouth thing. They didn't have singles. They didn't appear on TV. It's an incredible story just from that angle. But as you look, every time they went back to a territory that they played in, be it America or the UK, it got bigger and it grew bigger. And it got to the point in 1973, you know, 5 years on, where they were playing to 50,000. And they did set the template for the Rolling Stones and the U2s to do those things. Because, I mean, we call it Evenings with Led Zeppelin because that was exactly what it was. It got to the point where, you know, they just didn't need any support act. They just didn't need it. It was all about, you know, the Led Zeppelin 2 or 3 hour absolute total experience. So, and again, one of the beauties of the book is the way you see that build. It's an incredible story.
Yeah, towards that end, when you look at when they started out, they were starting out in clubs, some clubs less than 1,000 people, very small. But then they kept building and building and building. And then you get to 1973, and just their two nights alone, the first two nights of the tour alone, they had 49,000 and 56,000 in the first two nights. So it really demonstrated how they kept building. And, you know, the fans kept coming back for more and more and certainly in terms of ticket demand, it was off the charts. So and they kept that right the way all the way through to the very end, especially in the States, where they were huge.
If you think about it, they're doing this without having singles. You know, they're not doing it. They certainly haven't got social media. You know, they're not putting singles out. They're not being sort of, if you like, and this is before the invention of AOR, you know, an FM radio, which now, you know, and if you think you get to the late 70s when you've got, you know, you've got FM coming on, you've got Steely Dan and you've got Alan Parsons Project and REO Speedwagon, then that's much more centered towards that. So, but they're doing this in the early 70s. So it makes it even more remarkable.
Well, it completely. I mean, when I went to see them in 1975 at Earls Court, they played five shows and I went to each night of those shows. And they had a TV screen, well, a screen above the stage. And for a lot of people, it would have been the first time they'd seen moving images of Led Zeppelin because there was no YouTube, there was no TV, they hadn't made a film at that point. And it's an incredible thing that they earned it by word of mouth and by the music press, and there wasn't a lot of that really. And I think it was just a reputation that grew. You know, fans would go and they'd tell other people, and it became a unique thing. It was almost like a sort of a very big sort of secret, you know, society where, you know, if you were in it, you know, you were just completely obsessed with it. And I think Led Zeppelin did have a lot of obsessive fans, of which I count myself as one, and I'm sure Mike does. But that's how they did it. It was word of mouth. And it, again, when you look back and look at, you know, what, you know, funnel they had to get the word out, it was all about the music. It really was.
Yeah, I think to Dave's point as well, I mean, it's really an advantage for Zeppelin that they weren't in the Woodstock movie, because I do think that it adds an air of mystery to them, because, you know, you couldn't see them anywhere else. The only way you're going to see Led Zeppelin is either on the pages of a magazine or in concert, and that sense of mystery really, I think, helped benefit their entire career.
The other thing that struck me, I mean, was the before I start this show, believe it or not, I do prepare. I don't just come in here leg it, well, most of the time anyway. But, you know, and I'm looking through yesterday, looking through the notes, as my producer Wendy so kindly sends me all the information. And, you know, Plant had been West Country boy, you know, and I've just finished reading the Ozzy Osbourne autobiography, and he talks about bumping into Robert Plant with Geezer Butler at some point in Birmingham in like the late mid 60s, and Robert Plant looking like a rock star even then. And then, of course, we know Jimmy Page, session position, etc., and Bonham sprung fully formed, battling and doing drumsticks. But they were known in the UK. They were known, you know, as session musicians, as up and coming. So you would have thought the first gig would have been, you know, the 100 Club or, you know, some speakeasy in London or you know, or Birmingham or something. But no, a school gymnasium in Denmark. And I just honestly, there was tea everywhere. How did that happen?
Well, the story is they. As we know, the band emerged out of the last members of the Yardbirds, of which Jimmy Page was one, and he had the rights to the name, and they owed some dates, and Scandinavia were where those dates were. So when he formulated, you know, the new band, at that point, not called Led Zeppelin, still the Yardbirds or the new Yardbirds, they went out there and it was very low key, and it literally was. And I think the other thing, remarkable thing about that first gig is that there wasn't one gig. They played in the afternoon and then they played in the evening, which at that time wasn't unknown, because you went where, you know, the punters were. And I'm sure, as Mike can elaborate, it was a remarkable start. I mean, two gigs in one day.
Just before you come in there, Mike, I'm just thinking, a matinee with Led Zeppelin, that just blew my mind.
Yeah, I think the key thing for them too, by having those dates in Denmark early, in Sweden as well, it also helped them with their first album, because when you think about it, the first show was on September 7th. The first day they were in the studio was September 25th, which is actually 53 years ago tomorrow. But the thing is, they honed their craft even for the first album recording. By doing those first few weeks of dates, I think it helped them really build a chemistry so they can go into the recording studio and produce their first album.
And not only that, though, it is that remarkable turnaround between that, you know, Led Zeppelin 1, then you got 2, 3, and 4, and they just go bang, tour, album, tour, album, tour. I mean, it just, you look at, and it's not only that, but it's actually, I mean, anybody can put out three albums, being full of dross, but, I mean, I just played, you know, Your Time Is Going to Come off Led Zeppelin 2. Brilliant track. You know, they're all full of absolute, as the saying would go, the kids would say, bangers these days.
Well, I think with Zepp albums, no two album was, you know, the same. Every time they came back with something different. And that, again, really, I think, you know, grew the legacy. And, you know, I think people knew when they were getting a new Led Zeppelin album, they didn't know what they're in for. And, you know, it very quickly worked out that it wasn't just going to be about loud amplifiers. It was going to encompass folk and country and whatever they wanted to do. And that was the beauty of Led Zeppelin. It wasn't just about one facet of music. You know, within a rock framework, they were able to build around so many different influences. And again, when they took that live, it just really opened up. So I think there was something unique about that, that every album was completely different. And every time you went back, you knew there was going to be something interesting.
And towards that end, too, when they took those albums to concert, they really took it to another level, because, you know, they were able to take the framework of the albums and the songs and really build upon it in concert and present something that was really unique to everybody that was there. And they couldn't get enough. They wanted to come back more and more because they saw these songs in concert, and it really built into a new experience totally. So, you know, they made sure they took their albums to a whole new level.
And the other thing is that we were talking about the concert. No two concerts are the same. You go and see a band now and the set list comes out. And, it, you know, if it is a commercial band, you know exactly what you're getting. The set list, I mean, they basically play the same things. But you're dealing here with four exceptional characters, musicians. I mean, I saw Robert Plant in concert about 3 years ago, BC, before COVID. And he's still, and cleverly enough, he's now changed, and he's still, and he was with the Soul Shifters. And he's, what he's done cleverly is he's rearranged the songs, he's stripped them down so they fit his voice, because his voice obviously isn't the same as it was when he was a 20-something year old man. Very clever, great concert, brilliant shirt. But then you look at, you know, Jimmy Page, John Paul Jones, and Bonham. And I was having dinner last week with a couple of friends of mine who are musicians considerably better than me, and we were talking about Bonham and talking about how he set the drums up and how he used to set the drums up himself and the mics he used and the whole way that, so, you know, this whole conception, misconception of Zeppelin being these sort of monolithic, not knuckle draggers, but the archetypal rock and roll 70s rock stars. I mean, they were incredibly accomplished musicians, and Bonham especially. You know, the total attack on the drums when needed, but also the pulling back when necessary.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, it's, you know, it's a much banded phrase, but I think Bonham was the heart and soul of Led Zeppelin. You know, he drove it. The others were able to feed off that, but it was a unique chemistry. I mean, again, it was four people that blended, you know, and you don't get that chemistry often. And when you do, it is something special. And again, they were able to take that And the fact that they were able to last so long as well, because they were in a, you know, a real big rock market. You know, they had competition. There was always competition from The Who or The Stones, but they were just always out there, and they remained, you know, at the top. There was no number two albums. You know, they were always at the top. And when it stopped, obviously, unfortunately, when John died, you know, there were still new places to go for them. And I think they would have taken it into the 80s. There were changing times. The, obviously, punk and new wave had come in. And but I think they had a lot in them, you know, still to, you know, to really motor on. And that's something they always did. But I, as you rightly say, you know, Bonham, he really did drive it. And I think Jimmy and Jonesy and Robert understood where he came from. And there was a tremendous amount of detail in the way he played. And I think one of the things that's been said, I think Robert Plant once said, it wasn't necessarily about what, you know, what John played. It was, it was what he didn't play. He left the space for them to fill. You know, he didn't overfill with, real, you know, extensive drum fills. It was really, really, you know, sort of precise what he was doing. And they were able to play around that. So, and again, I think that's why, you know, it was so good for so long.
Yeah, the key with John Bonham is the band knew that they couldn't continue without John Bonham. John Bonham was such an important part of everything. He was so unique, so talented, and to just try to have somebody fill that seat would have been folly. I think they made a perfect decision by just calling it a day at that point, because there's no way, especially in concert, because, you know, he was so innovative, and he had a mind meld with Jimmy Page in terms of, you know, where they were going in concert, and John Paul, too, for that matter, that they knew they had to call it a day. And I think that was a smart decision.
I spoke to Steve Gorman, drummer of the Black Crowes, a while back. And he said, you know, anybody who said they prefer playing a stadium to playing a small club venue is just talking about the dollar, basically. And he said, you know, he now enjoys with his band Trigger Hippie the fact that, you know, he can play those small gigs again. I remember, because I was, you know, I was whatever age I was then, but I remember the Nebworth concert 79 being a massive affair. And we talk about the Madison Square Gardens, and, you know, they invented stadium rock, if you like. So how did they keep that freshness? How did they get a connect, if you like, with the audience, even though, you know, the gigs were getting, you know, bigger, the aircraft were getting bigger, and the build-up was getting, the pressure must have been getting bigger too.
Well, it indeed was. But one of the things about Led Zeppelin's fans were they were incredibly loyal, because they trusted them. They trusted that when they came back, and they'd had quite a long layoff when they came back to Nebworth, they had a lot to lose. And to come back on the biggest platform there was at that time, and they did two shows. You know, I think this week there's been a lot of press about, you know, the Oasis shows, which were fantastic in 1996, and they certainly did too. But Led Zeppelin had already set the template. But I think at the time, again, when I just mentioned about the punk and the new wave thing, you know, that wasn't for everybody, you know. And, you know, I think they still had a core audience, and they also picked up a new audience as well. I think, you know, a lot of the punk and new wave, you know, at the time they were, you know, giving it the old, you know, these are dinosaur bands. But I know for one, certainly Johnny Rotten liked Led Zeppelin, and a few of the other punks have come out since. It was unfashionable then, obviously, to say that. But I think the thing is, it was about loyalty, because you knew that you were going to get something special. And again, on that night, that first night, August the 4th, 79, they had a lot to lose. But by and large, they were absolutely amazing. And it was pure Zeppelin, you know, theatre. And that's what they were great at. They were great. I once interviewed Peter Grant, Led Zeppelin's manager.
Yeah.
And he said Led Zeppelin was an in-person band. And it was about, Led Zeppelin didn't play concerts, they played events. And every time you went, it was an event. And it didn't matter where it was or how many people they were playing to, that's what it felt like. And again, there's not many bands that can say that, and they certainly could all the way through.
Yeah, I think with Led Zeppelin too, especially in the States, because I really don't think the whole punk movement made the kind of impact in the States that it probably made in Europe. And Led Zeppelin fans were as loyal as can be. When they, you know, when you could sell out six dates at Madison Square Garden in a week in about 2 days, I mean, that pretty much says it all. And turn away probably a few more nights worth of gigs from that venue. they had a loyalty, but the loyalty was based on the fact that they kept delivering. They kept delivering great albums, whether it's Physical Graffiti, Presence. So there was always a demand for tickets. In that regard, I think a lot of fans also felt like a subculture loyalty to Led Zeppelin. They all felt a part of this underground group. It's kind of funny to think of Led Zeppelin as an underground group when they're outselling everybody in their concerts or even outselling everybody. But that's how it was. And one of the main reasons why is because they did not have a lot of publicity exposure. So that made a big difference as well. But all the fans really felt a lot of loyalty to Led Zeppelin.
Dave, you mentioned the formidable presence that was Peter Grant. I mean, how important was he in getting them these gigs? Because, I mean, you wouldn't muck with him, would you?
No, you wouldn't. I mean, he was a maverick manager, and he had been on the road with Gene Vincent and the likes. He had really earned his crust, as it were, even before it got to Led Zeppelin, and he knew exactly how to market the band, and he knew the American market inside out. I mean, he'd been been manager of the Yardbirds, and he'd been over there several times. And Richard Cole, the tour manager as well, was pretty pivotal. He knew how to get them from A to B in the shortest time. And when I look at the road crew of Led Zeppelin and the management, for a lot of years, it was five or six people. You know, these days, you'd have a 70 crew, you know, a 70-man crew. But certainly Peter Grant understood the rock market, and he nurtured it, and he didn't suffer fools, and he set the template, and he wouldn't let the record company dominate him. And I think, again, Led Zeppelin would have been a great band without Peter Grant, but with Peter Grant, they became an amazing band because he took them to places that they would have never got to in terms of audience sizes and just how he played it. Mike, when just mentioned about the sort of mystery of Led Zeppelin, he knew, you know, to have an album title that you can't actually say, it's made of four symbols, you know, always known as Led Zeppelin IV, we know. But when that first came out, it was just such a shock, you know, that, you know, I know Prince did it much, you know, later with the symbol that he had, but, you know, Zepp set the template again with that, you know, and there was something mysterious. The mystique always carried them through, and they never lent themselves to the media in a way, that was going to spoil that. I mean, it couldn't happen now. It just couldn't. But, you know, certainly during the 70s, they made that work beautifully. And that, again, as we said earlier, it made people want to come back because you knew we were talking about something special and it was going to be an event. But Peter Grant, he was key to the success, without a doubt.
Yeah, the key with Peter Grant, too, is because he took care of the whole business end of it. Unlike so many other bands, there's a laundry list of bands who got ripped off and didn't make a dime until like their fourth or fifth album. Led Zeppelin couldn't say that because of Peter Grant. But because he was so on it for them, they could focus totally on their music. And that made a big difference because, you know, they could hone their craft and not worry about whether, you know, where the money was coming from their next meal. So Peter Grant was essential to everything.
I just had a little laugh to myself, Dave, because I did that thing about media exposure and just thinking if, you know, had Led Zepp been around in the world of Instagram and social media, sort of at home with Jimmy Page, please excuse the Aleister Crowley pictures in the background. You know, there's all sorts of things, isn't there? Just, I mean, how do you go about then? Because, I mean, there have been books written about Zepp, obviously, tomes even. I mean, I've got quite a few lurking in the bookshelf at home. But how do you research that live concert? Now, Dave, obviously, you went to see them at Earl's Court, We're Not Worthy, etc. But, I mean, getting all that information together, because it's not simply, you know, the lazy thing was I just went on the internet and found it. I mean, presumably you did a bit more scholarly research to Perry than that. Dave first.
Well, it was great. It was great to obviously find Mike. I had been honing away. I'd written books on Led Zeppelin. I mean, one of my first books was called Led Zeppelin, The Final Acclaim. It certainly wasn't. And I had, you know, early on, I'd been trying to get a concert listing of where they'd played. And, you know, I remember in 1977, I had, you know, like an exercise book with a few dates in it. And that grew. And in the non-internet area, I did a book called The Concert File with a chap called Simon Pallett, which was a good first attempt at getting the history right. But then I met Mike, and he came on board with my magazine, the Led Zeppelin magazine that I published. And Mike's knowledge was unbelievable, and his research was just beyond. And Mike had done a lot of detail and gone to underground newspapers and libraries and chipped away. So we knew that we had a bank of info that we needed to put in a book format. And, you know, our publishers, Omnibus Press, looked on that favorably and gave us the time and scope to do it. I mean, it took another 4 or 5 years from the time we signed to do the book to actually get it right. But again, I can only say hats off to Mike, because his research was absolutely crucial, as he will tell you.
Well, I think the key thing too is that, you know, between the Type It Loose magazine that Dave runs and the books we've worked on, the key thing is this was done over so many years, because for many years, we had a live feature on a particular tour in Type It Loose. So that happened from, like, let's say, you know, 2009 to 2015 or so. The great thing is, because there was such a bank of material to really, compile, we were able to tell the story in a way where it wasn't jammed within, you know, we had a year deadline to get it done and get it done. So it really happened over a very long period of time. And Dave and I have worked together on quite a number of projects. So we have a good chemistry in terms of working together and making sure that the end result is what we want it to be. But I think the most important thing is our vision was identical for the book. And to be able to, you know, set out, have a game plan for what we want the book to be, and then to have the final result pretty much match exactly what the original intention was, is pretty gratifying.
And the other thing, of course, is with the benefit of hindsight, you know, we know what happens in 1980, but where were they going? Because they obviously, Zeppelin didn't know it was going to finish. They didn't know that 1980 gig in Berlin was going to be the last one. What was coming up in terms of live performances after that? What did they have scheduled?
Well, it's very interesting, because in 1980, they did a tour of Europe, and it was very scaled down. It was very low key. Didn't get much press coverage. I went out there and saw 5 shows, and there was a definite sense of rejuvenation. They'd cut a lot of the longer numbers out. You know, they were lean and they were looking to move on, and they would have taken that to America in the autumn. But certainly I felt a sense of rejuvenation. You know, I think between the 4 of them, you know, the bigger gigs were beginning maybe to not be the way forward. I think they needed to find a different medium, and just, I think the whole light show thing and all that, it had been done to death, and I think they needed to reconcile that. And in Europe, I felt that. I saw, you know, there was second night. It was a fantastic gig in Cologne. I mean, they just, you know, they began with Train Kept a Rolling, which was a number that they used to do. It used to be the set opener in 1968, you know, in the first gig. So by going back to their history and, you know, playing something like that, you know, you felt that there was new places to go. So I think, had they been able to go to America, and they were scaling the shows down, it was still a massive thing. They were doing 4 nights in various places, but I think that would have scaled down, because I think the whole rock thing anyway was beginning to get a bit, you know, sort of flabby. And I think they understood that, and they'd done the Nebulous. What was next? So the next best thing is to go and rejuvenate yourself, play to smaller, you know, amounts of people. You know, the stage was a lot less, you know, emphatic, and everything about it was, yes, we can still do it, but we need to reinvent it a bit. And again, I didn't see the final gig, but I saw the second from last gig in Munich. And again, I felt that they still had new places to go. And I think, had they got to America, they would have reclaimed it. It's worth mentioning that there were bands in America, the Rushes, the Van Halens, that were there ready to take their crown, and by not being visible because they hadn't played there due to various circumstances, they really needed to show themselves. I think Led Zeppelin really needed to get back to the people. I think had they had toured further in 1981 and come back to England, they would have been playing, you know, the Rainbows, you know, the Hammersmiths. It didn't have to be Wembley or Earls Court anymore. You know, I think they could have toned it down. But, you know, ultimately, in 1980, Led Zeppelin still had new places to go, and I was lucky enough to see that. So I feel very privileged that I did. And I think all the band felt that. I mean, I spoke to all of them on that tour, and particularly John Bonham, who, you know, he was often homesick, and they didn't want to go away for long. So, and again, that's the other thing. And Richard Cole, the tour manager, told us all this, that they were trying to have a base and then they would go out to these gigs and come back. So they didn't have to be away for 6 to 8 weeks or whatever. There were new days, and I think there would have been a whole lot better days, and that, you know, they would have got it back. I really do think that.
We're going to run out of time, gentlemen. I could talk to you about this until literally the proverbials come home, as you can probably tell. This book is called Evenings with Led Zeppelin, The Complete Concert Chronicle. It's by Dave Lewis and Mike Tremaglio. Gentlemen, if people want to find you on the internet, where can they get you?
I'm at www.typebutloose.co.uk, and my website is updated regularly, and all the info about the books and what we do and what I've done over many years is all on there. So point your browsers to there and you'll find about the world of Led Zeppelin according to us.
Mike, where can they find you, my friend?
You can pretty much find me at Dave's Type But Loose, just the information you just provided, and also on Facebook at my own name.
This book is called Evening with Led Zeppelin. Cups of tea would be provided. The Complete Concert Chronicle. It's by Dave Lewis and Mike Tremaglio. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure to speak to you today.
Thanks,
folks. Thank you very much.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.